Foreign companies are farming in La Paz County, and some officials there are concerned. They're thinking about the water supply.
This is not an attack against farmers or anything like that. It is about the fact that how do we protect our groundwater and make sure that we have enough.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, who are Arizona's independent voters? Creating a dream team to take on one of the deadliest forms of cancer.
Helping former foster children navigate one of the country's biggest universities.
And The Apprentice. No, not that one.
The things that I've learned here will definitely put me on top of that list of, like, applicants. And I think that's, like, really important that that I have that opportunity.
Plus, we hit the beach and take a deep dive on internet security.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. It'll be sunny for the rest of the afternoon today. Look for a high of 78 degrees, right around average for today. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 50, sunny and 80 for a high tomorrow. It's 73 degrees right now at KJZZ, and quickly checking traffic, I-10 eastbound in the West Valley, a collision at State Route 85. Gas prices in Arizona are up a bit this week. AAA Arizona says a gallon of regular unleaded now costs an average of $2.14. That's up a fraction of a penny from last week. Nationwide, gas prices dipped more than a cent to $2.20 a gallon. Tucson continues to have the cheapest average gas prices in the state, with Flagstaff having the highest. Among states in the continental U.S., South Carolina has the lowest average price. California has the highest.
Independent or unaffiliated voters continue to register at a growing rate in Arizona, as they now make up 38% of the state's registered voters. Today, the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission, in collaboration with ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy, released a report that asks the question, who is Arizona's independent voter? To learn more, I'm joined by Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan and Tom Collins, Executive Director of the Clean Elections Commission. Secretary Reagan, did anything surprise you? In particular, how independents see themselves.
One of the things that surprised me was how they saw themselves as able to make a huge difference in campaigns and in elections. And they certainly can if they show up at the polls and if they vote. And we know by looking at just this past election, they don't show up in huge numbers. So I found that surprising. They see themselves as big change agents.
Tom, initially, any surprises from the study?
You look at the folks saying that they're voting when they're not in fact voting, and then also not being fully informed about when they can participate and how they can. I mean, that's a real challenge. It's something that the commission has been working on an ongoing basis for the last couple of elections, and so we think that by sponsoring this research, it'll help us enhance that.
Are there efforts being made to get more independents to vote? Should that be a priority for not just your office, but generally?
Oh, it absolutely should be a priority. When you have the highest voting bloc now being independent voters, and that's one-third of our state's voting system now is independents, it should be a priority, not just for independents, but for all of the voting members that we have. We need to make sure people are coming to the polls and they have access to the polls and know when to vote and how to vote. You know, we throw terms around like permanent early voting list or presidential preference election. They're just normal terms for us, but they're not to the average voter. Secretary of State's office, we've hired what we call voting rights ambassadors to get out into the communities, and especially minority communities. Their goal as voting rights ambassadors is to register people to vote, yes, but more importantly, to educate them on what their rights are as voters. Where are the polls? How do you get to the polls? How do you find out where the polls are at? How do you sign up for an early ballot? Who do you contact if you don't get it? And to be able to communicate to people in different languages, too. We've been out doing extensive outreach in schools and extensive outreach digitally, because that's how people talk these days. It's not on paper like it used to be.
Tom, how big a priority should it be to attract more independent voters to make sure that they're not just registering as independents, but they're actually voting?
Well, I think that, you know, the fact of the matter is that if you decide not to vote, you're simply ceding your vote to somebody else. You're letting somebody else make the decision for you. And so, you know, I think what the study demonstrates is that independent voters see themselves as voters who vote on issues. And on the same time, they seem to be find themselves in some way disconnected from the you know, the system of electing candidates. Well, the reality is that when you're voting for a candidate, you are in fact voting for an issue, because candidates are elected to make decisions that affect your life. So any independent who, and I think largely this, study demonstrates that independents want to go issue by issue. Well, at the end of the day, you know, the only way you can get your issue heard is by casting your ballot. And that happens to be for a candidate in a candidate election. It's for an issue in an issue-based election. But making that connection for folks and making it more salient is important, so that folks understand not only the structure of how they're participating, all the things they need to know, which Secretary Reagan identifies, but also how we make that communication salient to them, how we make sure they understand why.
How much of this responsibility rests with an individual voter? I'm an independent who will get the ballot I need to get based on Arizona's system. Do more people, if they really, I don't want to say care about the issues, but really want to get involved in the issues, do they need to at least realize the system we have and take hold and go vote?
I think that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the Clean Elections Act provides tools for voters to be engaged with the system. The Secretary of State's office provides tools to allow voters to be engaged in the system. And we can, I think, as it, you know, folks who work in this area do a better job of communicating to voters about the existence of those tools. But at the end of the day, a tool is only as useful as the person who's using the tool. And so I think that as long as we can, we have to do a better job of communicating that the tools are out there.
And we're working on that right now, educating people, just the difference of the different kinds of primaries. We know that independents, we want every independent to know that they can vote in primaries in Arizona. It's not that way in a lot of other states around the country. We're proud of the fact that in Arizona, independents can vote in the primaries, except for the presidential primary. So one election every 4 years, there is one primary that independents can't vote in, and that happens to be next year in March, the presidential primaries.
I want to have you tell a brief story, if you can, about your experience when you were running for the legislature, your experience with reaching out to independent voters and how it worked.
When I was in the legislature, I'm from a district that is heavily skewed Republican, which is great for me because I am a Republican. But that being said, my race then was in the primary. So I usually had very competitive primaries, usually pretty brutal. And then, but once I got out of the primaries, I was usually very safe in the general election. One of the things I did was to court independent voters to come into the primary election and to participate, because a few independents coming in to a low turnout primary election could really make or break the race for a candidate. I really wish more independents had, you know, looking back, I wish more independents had realized the power they could have had in a district like mine, where the game is in the primary. So I spent quite a bit of campaign money, quite a bit of my war chest, if you will, on courting independents to come, sending them postcards, basically spoon feeding the ballot to them. Here, sign here and you'll get your ballot. It'll be mailed right to you. Multiple efforts. And I ended up winning. But looking back, and when we did the canvas to see who voted, it barely a blip.
Tom, finally, the report asks the really provocative question, who is Arizona's independent voter? Is there a real takeaway for this? Because it's a fascinating report. Do you think it will lead to action?
From the commission perspective, as the commissioners examine it, as we're going into next election year, it will provide the commission a lot of information to work on making sure that our voter education program continues to be looking at voters' perspective and informed by what voters are telling us they need to hear about. And that's really important. And I think that that's probably, for us, the most important thing. But I think it's also important to realize that you've got a group of people who represent the largest voting bloc of the state who really don't want to be categorized into a party. That's something they believe very strongly. And that was a big takeaway from the report.
They don't want to see they don't see independent as a party. It's independent as a mindset. How do I find them, and how do I make sure they have easy access to the polls?
Michelle Reagan is Arizona Secretary of State. Tom Collins is Executive Director of the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Foreign companies have been coming into La Paz County in western Arizona and setting up farming operations. And some county officials are concerned the lack of groundwater regulations there could pose a problem for residents. La Paz County Supervisor Holly Irwin is one of those who's worried, and she joins me. Holly, why is this causing problems?
This has been a major concern for the people that I represent. In the last few years, they've had difficulties with wells that are failing. And so they're having to go and dig a lot deeper to get to water. And that has been the concern over the years, is that, you know, within this basin that, you know, that the water table continues to drop. And I want to make it very clear that I'm all about farming. This is not an attack against farmers or anything like that. It is about the fact that how do we protect our groundwater and make sure that we have enough for the people that have lived here, the people that are here, and for our economic future.
The land that these companies are using, what was it being used for before?
It had been used for farming before, you know, in the past, but you have these people that are coming from other countries that are now using our natural resources, because you got to remember, they have used up their own. And this has been going on for quite some time. The Saudis, unfortunately, they just happen to be the ones that put it in a news article, which is kind of what grabbed the attention of this whole thing. So it kind of brings to the forefront, you know, the fact that how do we get something in place, a mechanism to allow assured water for the people that live here, that have lived here, you know, that will continue to live here. And we're talking about, people that are on fixed incomes. You know, when you're having to go from 650 feet down to 800, you know, that's a substantial amount to go down, and it's not coming back up.
Well, what kind of regulation do you think would be fair both to these companies that are coming in and doing business and presumably bringing some kind of economic benefit to La Paz County, but also to protect the groundwater and protect the folks, as you say, who have been there for generations?
Well, and that's why I think that the help needs to come from ADWR as well. You know what I mean? They're the ones that issue permits. You know, they're the ones that can oversee certain things and be able to tell us as to where we are, how we go about regulating. You know, we need to make sure that we have enough water for the people that live here. But we need to make sure, too, that they're not pumping out in excess, you know, more than what they should be doing.
Does the fact that these companies that are doing this farming are from not only out of state but out of country, is that different to you somehow than if an Arizona company or a California company came in and basically had the same kind of operation?
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing for me is what we're starting to see a trend with, too, to be honest with you, is we do have farming companies that are coming in, and they're leasing land that's out here as well, which this is another issue that we're also seeing, is we have a company that has came in, purchased land, you know, they do have land here, and then they're turning around and they're leasing it to farmers from California that are here, utilizing water as well. Now they're building reservoirs to hold this water in, to pump the water into a reservoir. And to be quite frank, the people that own this land are leasing it out for thousands and thousands of dollars on the acre. And, you know, and if you start taking a look at, like, the assessed value, you know, the values of the land itself, it's not being looked at as the value of the land. You know, they're only paying a fraction of what they should be for what the actual value of the land is.
What kind of economic benefits is this trend bringing to La Paz County? I would imagine that having foreign companies coming in and doing business and then exporting it from there probably helps the county in some way, right?
Well, you know, it helps by way of jobs, and again, like I said, there, you know, we have these companies that are coming in and purchasing this land for millions and millions and millions of dollars, but yet we're not really seeing the actual value of what that is as a tax rate. You know, like as far as taxes go, they're paying just a small fraction on taxes for what it's assessed for, not what the value of the land actually is.
Holly Irwin is a La Paz County supervisor. Holly, thank you.
Thank you so much.
About 6 years ago, the federal government raided a number of homes in the Four Corners region, arrested 24 men and women, and seized nearly 40,000 artifacts. That was just the start of a saga that led to 2 suicides and charges against more than 20 people that included violating the Federal Archaeological Resources Protection Act. The Bureau of Land Management in Utah has been in charge of studying the artifacts and working on getting them back to their proper tribal owners. Nate Thomas is Deputy Preservation Officer for the BLM Utah. Nate, can you give us an idea of the scope of the collection, and is anything especially surprising or significant?
Well, it's a very large collection. I'm not aware of a collection this large outside of a museum. The collection is very diverse. We have, of course, we have a lot of the common artifacts that you would see in the Four Corners area, such as groundstone, pottery, pottery fragments, projectile points. But what's also surprising is there's a lot of perishable items, such as basketry, sandals, arrow shafts.
I imagine, just based on how we hear about budgets, state government, federal government, they're, I'm sure you're not overrun with employees to take care of this kind of thing. So what's the process of going through all these?
From the very beginning, the Bureau of Land Management and the other federal agencies were very interested in taking care of these artifacts. Right from the very beginning, one thing we wanted to make sure is that they were housed in an appropriate location with security and climate control. And we also brought in a museum curator, and that museum curator's job was to make sure that, you know, each artifact is identified correctly, it's placed in the appropriate containers with the appropriate material so that it's secure, and then put it in a location where we can actually go back and find it.
As a situation, how disturbing is it ultimately when you find things like this? Yes, it's obviously it's exciting in one sense, but then it's also, I imagine, kind of troubling in another sense?
Sure. You know, these artifacts are protected by the Archaeological Resource Protection Act, and they're also protected by the Native American Graves and Reparation Protection Act. Besides that, though, sure, there is an emotional component to these. It doesn't, in my perspective, any sort, no matter what your culture is or what your background is, when looters and vandals decide to excavate human remains just so that they can keep those sacred objects that were placed there with that individual, sure, I think that can be disturbing.
And Nate, what is the process going forward now of connecting with Native communities on proper identification and returning the items? I presume that's the ultimate goal, but that's got to be a long-term process as well, right?
It will be a long-term process. We've made great strides over the past year. Recently, we've finished the inventory, and we've photographed most of the artifacts, and we've gone through and placed pictures and descriptions of those artifacts on a secure website that only tribal governments will be able to view.
Is there something going forward in the future to make it less likely for this sort of thing to happen again?
Well, the BLM Utah has started a partnership with the organization Tread Lightly. They've been excellent at promoting, you know, the responsible use of public lands. We're starting a partnership with them to do an ad campaign, and that ad campaign is called Respect and Protect. And we're hoping that this campaign will be the catalyst to start changing people's perceptions of looting.
Nate Thomas is Deputy Preservation Officer for the Bureau of Land Management in Utah.
Coming up, there's a new type of dream team assembling, but not on the basketball court.
We're looking at how can we increase awareness of the potential benefits of clinical trials that not only help the individual, but help us move the science forward.
A full court press on cancer. That's just ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark. I'm Steve. It's the show on KJZZ. In Valley traffic, an accident on I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue is blocking the shoulder. There's also a collision I-10 eastbound at State Route 85. Valley weather for the rest of the day. We're expecting mostly sunny skies with high temperatures perhaps creeping into the upper 70s. Then for tonight, clear, relatively cool with lows in the upper 40s. And then for tomorrow, sunny skies and a high near 79. Currently mostly clear, 75 degrees at 223.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo on behalf of the West Valley Symphony's first-time winners and one-hit wonders. This Sunday at the Valley Vista Performing Arts Center in Surprise. Details at westvalleysymphony.org.
There were more than 14,000 kids in foster care or with relatives in Arizona as of March. In 2013, state lawmakers approved a bill giving tuition waivers at public universities and community colleges to any foster child who'd been in care on or after their 16th birthday. In response, ASU started a program called Bridging Success. For more on it, I'm joined by Justine Chung, Bridging Success's program coordinator, and ASU freshman Cynthia Alafa, who's a part of the program. Chung says it's a multifold mission.
One is to recruit youth to come to university. We have conversations about, yes, you can go to school. What does that look like? Inform them. We spend a lot of time talking about how does it get paid for, because it's more than just tuition and fees. The second thing we do is, the academic word for it is retention, meaning I specifically engage with any student who has been in care and provide resources. I provide an ear. I do a lot of mentoring. I do a lot of problem solving with them, teaching them life skills. So it's just whatever I need to do to make sure that they're getting their needs met while they're at our university.
What is the need as far as this kind of program to encourage, help foster kids to be able to go to college?
There is a big need. Often what I'm experiencing with these young people is they don't have people to support them in this process. The message isn't always, oh yes, you can go to college. That they need a person that they can say, I want to go, what do I do next? And I have walked many, many young people through the process of applying, figuring out financial aid, telling them what a FAFSA is, giving them resources in the community. There's roughly 700 to 800 young people that age out of the foster care system every year. And we lose them in the transitions from young adulthood into adulthood. And when that happens, statistically, these young people end up homeless. They end up getting back into services provided by the state or the federal government. They end up being young parents. So there's a huge need to open the door to education so that these young people can have a really bright future. Statistically, it shows anybody who gets a college education fares better in the long run, and that's what we want to see happen with these young people.
So it sounds like it's more than just help paying for it or figuring out how to pay for it. It's here's how you apply, here's what you need to do to apply, here's how you pick your dorm, things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's often a phone call, okay, what have you done this week? They finish their application. Okay, what do you need to do next? Let's look at your portal. Here's your tasks. You need to get your immunization records, which records are often a huge barrier for these young people. So helping them get birth certificates, social security numbers, everything they need to do to apply.
Cynthia, how did you get connected with this program?
I was connected through one of the scholarships that I applied for and ended up getting. They recommended to go through the program. It was a recommendation.
At what point did college sort of become a reality for you?
Probably my last semester in senior year. It's like, oh yeah, it's really happening. Just an eye-opener, and that I can go to college. And I was fortunate enough to have someone to push me towards that goal.
Having gone through the program, how has it helped you? I mean, how has it sort of helped you navigate your first several weeks and months at college?
The resources they provided us was very useful. A lot of the resources were towards Tempe, but they also gave us resources for all of the four different campuses, so that was helpful.
And you're at the downtown campus, right?
Correct. So the resources and knowing that they are building this support system, because without the support system, it is hard to go through college. So knowing that they're there for us and willing to listen is very helpful.
Justine, what are the biggest challenges that you find the students that you're working with are facing and bringing to your attention?
On the one hand, a lot of them are normal freshman year challenges, right? Managing time, making sure I get my assignments in on time, figuring out how to use the technology that they have to interface with. Those are like common universal experiences. I think the other thing is building friendships, getting a sense of community. ASU is known for being big. I think it is. It really is feeling, trying to find that sense of community, that I belong here, that I'm worthy to be here, that I can do this. They haven't heard that a lot. Many of my students haven't heard that a lot, that they are capable. And yet they're some of the most resilient people I've ever met. So it is finding people to connect with and feel like they belong. Do you think that's true?
Yes, Cynthia, you're nodding your head as Justine was saying that.
Yeah, I do agree. The program is about finding your inner self and building the community, because that's what's going to get you through college is those people who are going to be there for you.
Justine, how do you ultimately judge whether or not this program is working?
There's many factors, and I think the ultimate measure for us is, are they finding community? Are they finding people in ASU, not just me, but all across campuses, that support them, that help them reach their educational goals, that help them reach their social and professional goals?
Cynthia, what would you say sort of is the biggest thing that you have learned, the biggest benefit that you've gotten so far? I guess, how has this program helped you the most so far?
It all goes back to the community. This semester started off rough, and then I realized that it's important to build that community, knowing, having somebody there, knowing that they're going to push you through it and they're going to be there with your highs and lows. And that's the most important thing, that somebody is there and they're going to push you through it, whether it's being there at your success or your lowest, and they're willing to listen.
Cynthia Alafa is a freshman at ASU. We also heard from Justine Chung, the program coordinator for Bridging Success at ASU, which helps former foster children at the university.
A famous research foundation is turning the traditionally tedious and competitive process of awarding grants upside down by forming dream teams. Now, two Arizona institutions have been selected to be part of a team to take on one of the most deadly yet overlooked forms of cancer. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Andrew Bernier reports.
When you hear the words dream team, people may think of sports superstars coming together to take on the world. But a different kind of team has been assembled across international lines, not to sink last-second three-pointers, but sink one of the deadliest diseases, pancreas cancer.
It's estimated by next year, pancreas cancer will become the second leading cause of death from cancer in the United States.
That's Daniel Vonhoff of the Translational Genomics Research Institute, or TGen. He is the lead of the Dream Team awarded the $12 million grant from Stand Up to Cancer, a highly selective research foundation. While research funding typically pits scientists and institutions against one another, Vonhoff explains how the Dream Team format is different.
Very unique model. The idea was to get people that are usually competitors in the area competing for the same grants to kind of interview each other, assemble a team, work together, and when these teams were assembled, then to have those teams compete, you generate a lot of new ideas against the disease.
Vonhoff believes his dream team was selected because funding for other forms of cancer, such as breast and prostate, have accelerated their treatment research. The team wants to take a new approach by focusing on patterns in patients and the molecular programming in the tumor cells that spreads pancreas cancer, soon to be second only to lung for cancer-related deaths.
People would usually lose weight. They develop fluid in the abdomen. It always goes to the liver, so it has a pattern of how it progresses. Almost 100% of the patients have a gene abnormality. So maybe the clue here is cancer is like a wound. As soon as you cut yourself, it starts healing. But this cancer, it keeps going.
Vonhoff says this is his second pancreatic cancer dream team. While the initial research is done at TGen in Phoenix, Honor Health in Scottsdale is one of three locations where the clinical studies are taking place. The others are in Pennsylvania and in London. But the grant requires researchers to work quickly, just like cancer does. Clinical testing from this grant must start in 6 months, while the original grant testing is well underway. Even though pancreas cancer is often lethal, Honor Health's Erkut Borazansi, the team's principal clinical investigator, says initial testing is promising.
We reported that in the first 10 individuals with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, 8 of the first 10 had at least a decrease of 30% or more of their tumor. Furthermore, 2 of those individuals had complete disappearance of their cancer.
Borazansi says while 10 individuals makes for a small clinical trial, it increases focus on patients' responses to the therapy.
We don't want to waste an individual's time. We want to give them the best shot. And then if something works, that means that we want to continue that. If it doesn't appear to be as effective, then we need to change gears. So any person going through a clinical trial today, they're being reevaluated by an individual basis.
Right now, the one-year survival rate is 35%. Borazansi says the goal is to double that. But while the treatment has been effective, he says it can also take a tremendous toll on a patient's body.
There really is no truly harmless therapy out there. So let's say an individual has a complete response. Well, that therapy may have caused nerve damage, problems with their digestive system. While it's great that the therapy may have caused them to have that great of a response, it's very difficult for an individual to be on these therapies.
Gail Jamison is a nurse practitioner with the research. She often sees patients who've tried all other treatment options before choosing this clinical trial. While they will help these patients, they want to see more patients with early diagnosis prior to any treatment.
Many folks who look at clinical trials have possibly exhausted standard types of treatment. We prefer to see patients at time of diagnosis so we can evaluate and see if they may be eligible for one of our clinical trials upfront, rather than after they've had multiple lines of therapy.
Jamison says one of the most difficult parts of clinical trials is getting patients involved. Some get doctor referrals, but many are self-referred and were searching for other options.
Patients may not be referred from their primary physician. So we're looking at how can we increase awareness of the potential benefits of clinical trials that not only help the individual, but help us move the science forward.
This is a 3-year grant, but more than 20 scientists from 10 institutions on 2 different continents are working together to encourage the hopes and dreams of cancer patients for many more years to come. From Scottsdale, I'm Andrew Bernier, KJZZ News.
Still to come, increased awareness of bullying has helped reduce it, but it's also had another effect.
In a sense, it's good that people are waking up to the fact that it happens, but on the downside, what's happening is people are starting to think that any inappropriate behavior by a child is bullying, and that's just not true.
Defining bullying and teaching the social skills to prevent it. That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show, a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley and the region, along with national and international news. Valley weather for the rest of today. We should have mostly sunny skies, and we may top out in the upper 70s. Currently, it's mostly sunny and 76 degrees. In Valley traffic, watch out for one accident. It's on I-10 eastbound at State Route 85. It's 236.
KJZZ is supported by Fenimore Craig, a full-service law firm collaborating on new business ventures and technology startups for 130 years. FenimoreCraig.com.
The campaign for the Republican presidential nominee has so far been anything but predictable, with 2 non-traditional politicians leading the polls. Donald Trump and Ben Carson are known for speaking their minds. To their supporters, they seem to be talking from the heart. To their detractors, they can seem insensitive and crude.
So are these so-called authentic candidates an American creation, or do people in other countries around the globe recognize these kinds of politicians? Here are the few examples of politicians around the world who've never been too afraid to be themselves is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones.
Once upon a time, many politicians could be relied upon to say what they meant. But in a world of instant media and spin doctors, complete frankness can seem in short supply. But that doesn't mean the so-called authentic politician doesn't exist. Take former Italian leader Silvio Berlusconi, for example, a man given to simply voicing what he felt.
I have always worked with no interruption. And if I sometimes see a beautiful girl, I say, better to like girls than to be gay.
That's Silvio Berlusconi, who once said, quote, I'm not a saint, you've all understood that. Here in Britain, a completely different kind of public persona in Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Opposed to the monarchy, he famously refused to sing the national anthem, God Save the Queen, at a World War II memorial service. That earned him criticism, even from some within his own party. He's also known for looking like a rumpled professor than he is a slick politician. Mr. Corbyn has won followers for what most believe is an authentic crusade for the poor.
We've got a fantastic opportunity now here in 2015 to liberate the poorest from the misery and poverty in which they live. That surely is something worth staying in the party for, worth fighting for, and worth campaigning for. Thank you very much.
That's Britain's Jeremy Corbyn. Cross over to Iran and you'll recall the much criticised former president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He earned rebuke in the West for speaking his mind, making numerous inflammatory remarks, including calling the Holocaust a myth. But perhaps it was his folksy language with Iranians that made some believe he was an authentic politician. Literally, that means the boob you're looking for has been stolen by the bogeyman. It's a colloquial phrase relating to a breastfeeding child that essentially means the good times are over. Those kinds of statements horrified Iran's middle class and intelligentsia. But as BBC Persian's Hossein Sharif explains, that was the intent.
He knows that his core message was not new. His core message was something that had been broadcast to the public in the previous three decades. And the clever marketing executive that he is, he needed something to differentiate his product from the other stuck-up, rigid politicians, and that's partly why he did it.
In which case, was it really authentic, or was it a clever piece of self-marketing? Discuss. There are also, of course, downsides to authenticity. Take the case of Australia's former Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Known, among other things, for quite a few gaffes, his political opponents also claimed he had a woman problem. Here's the BBC's John Donison reporting on an awkward moment for Abbott last year during a radio call-in programme.
And I work on an adult sex line to make ends meet.
As Gloria lambasted Mr. Abbott over his recent budget, he was winking, a smirk on his face, not clever, when there was a camera in the room.
What do you suggest I cut out, Mr. Abbott? Christmas birthday presents to my grandchildren?
Those indiscretions finally caught up with Mr. Abbott. He was recently deposed as leader of his party, showing perhaps that authenticity, in other words, being yourself, doesn't always mean longevity. From the BBC in London, I'm Rob Hugh-Jones.
Efforts to prevent bullying have been gaining steam, and one of the big aspects of that is teaching kids the social and emotional skills they need to treat their classmates and others with respect. Joan Duffel thinks about this a lot. She's the executive director of the Nonprofit Committee for Children, which focuses on bullying prevention and the development of those skills.
Socially emotional skills in children plays a very big role in preventing and reducing bullying behavior. Quite often, children who are engaging in bullying behavior really need to be redirected and taught, you know, how to enact the behaviors that are pro-social versus antisocial. So, you know, we have to teach those skills to kids.
At what age is it appropriate to start doing this?
Well, you know, really from the time a child is born, they should be really connecting emotionally with their parents and caregivers. But as children start to enter preschool and early learning centers, that's when we really focus on those caregivers and teachers really focusing on social and emotional development.
So do you find that there are instances in which kids are perhaps bullying classmates and aren't aware of the fact that they're doing it?
Oh, absolutely. That happens all the time. And it's one of the reasons it's so important to be very specific and clear and definitive about the definition of bullying. Because actually, many times, and I think this has happened since public awareness has grown about the issue of bullying, in a sense, it's good that people are waking up to the fact that it happens, but on the downside, what's happening is people are starting to think that any inappropriate behavior by a child is bullying, or any conflict behavior that kids are having is a result of bullying, and that's just not true. The field of bullying prevention generally is pretty clear that you have to define bullying in a certain way so that the behaviors that really fall inside that definition can really be addressed as bullying behaviors, and those that don't fall inside that definition shouldn't be overzealously identified as bullying. So, because that's also bad. If you start thinking everything is bullying, then nothing is. And we define it in ways that kids can understand and adults. So we say bullying is often unfair and one-sided. So it's not a mutual exchange of teasing. It's really a one-sided thing. There is always a power imbalance involved, and then it needs to be repeated.
I think it's interesting what you said about sort of the sensitivity, because I think there is a lot more attention now on bullying, as you no doubt know. And it's interesting to me that part of your job seems to be trying to tell people, look, that might not actually be bullying. With all the attention on trying to prevent bullying and reduce it, some of what you're doing is saying that's just bad behavior. That's just kind of typical bad child behavior, but it's not actual bullying.
Right. And I think this is such an important distinction to make, because children by nature are developing, right? They're not mature adults. They're immature. They're children. So partly how they learn to be better in a social setting with other people is by making mistakes. So children make social mistakes all the time. Any parent knows this. And so when they do, what's important is to help teach them in that teachable moment, what's the better social behavior?
Is there an age by which the definition maybe changes a little bit? I'm thinking maybe like by the time a student gets to college or gets into their 30s or something, some of that behavior that is sort of normal developmental behavior, maybe when they're a little older, isn't so innocent and such a learning moment anymore.
Yes, absolutely. We have to take child development and human development stages into account. So by the time kids are, at least in high school, we should be expecting them to really know how to behave more appropriately with each other and to have at least a cognitive, a thinking understanding of what that looks like to treat another person thoughtfully and not thoughtlessly.
Joan Duffel is the executive director of the Nonprofit Committee for Children. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark. He's Steve. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now, 75 degrees at KJZZ at 247.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where medical experts work together across specialties to improve diagnosis and treatment for patients with the most complex conditions. More at mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Just like the numerous communication satellites that link up in space and provide a web of information flowing everywhere in the world 24 hours a day, there are high-bandwidth underwater cables that are still doing the same things and more worldwide. Just as there has been a concern about future threats to satellites, the vulnerability of undersea cables has become an American national security concern, as Russian military vessels are now operating near these cables. For decades, the cables have endured the regular disruptions of fishing vessels. But can the underground cable network endure something more premeditated and nefarious? Nicole Staroselsky is author of The Undersea Network. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
I guess as a security matter, I'm glad there's someone studying the undersea cable. I suggest that's a rather obscure topic for media at NYU, but
it's true. There aren't many people in academia and universities studying undersea cables.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it. Are they threatened by Russian ships and anything more than accidents by fishing vessels?
Well, I wouldn't underestimate the accidents by fishing vessels. Between, 1959 and 2006, 60% of all of the disruptions were fishing vessels and boats, most of these not premeditated. It's actually a rarity to have deliberate sabotage of a cable system. So I'm not sure that this is any greater a threat than the already existing threat that is out there.
And if a cable were to go down or a series of cables were to go down, how would I notice that? How would I understand that? Would it impede phone traffic, internet traffic? Would it be something I'd be able to see?
Well, here in the United States, you probably wouldn't see you wouldn't really know. It would take a lot of cables to go down for that to happen. Cables go down probably on average once every 3 days, or about you know, 200 or so faults a year. Estimates vary, but they are severed regularly. But usually traffic is redirected. And in the U.S., a lot of the traffic, the internet traffic is domestic, right? There's a lot of internet content hosted here. And there are a lot of cables. So you'd have to sever quite a few cables in order to take down the United States internet.
Who owns the cables? Everyone? No one?
Large telecommunications companies own cables. Recently, like Google has laid cables. You have a lot of different cable owners out there. But usually governments don't own cables. So to think about a U.S. cable doesn't really make sense. There are cables that are shared or connect countries and that are owned by multiple telecommunications carriers. But there are rarely cables that are solely one government's system.
You know, it's often the electric grid is spoken of as being very vulnerable because it's very difficult to rewire and to reroute current and electricity. But it sounds like the undersea information cable system is much more easy to reroute, has more plasticity in it.
Yes, definitely. It automatically reroutes upon break. Doesn't even take somebody to push a switch to say, oh, it broke, now we need to figure out an alternate route. That's done automatically.
Whose good idea was that? Because that's not something we associate with the infrastructure.
Well, that's something that was designed into the system from the beginning of the kind of fiber optic era. The internet, the people who have set up the cable systems have designed it that way.
Are we low tech under the sea and high tech in space? Or are cables always going to be necessary and will be, in some level, on the cutting edge of our communications ability?
Well, cables are the cutting edge of our transoceanic global communications network. I mean, they are the backbone. They carry almost 100% of all transoceanic traffic. Satellites really connect places that don't have cables. And yet, at the same time, they are extraordinarily low tech. They're laid much in the same way that they were laid 150 years ago. They're wound up in a boat, and the boat goes across the ocean, and they drop to the seafloor. When they need to be repaired, they, drag it up and splice it. It's pretty low tech in terms of, it's grounded in a long history, practices staying fairly the same.
But the low tech is something we should be feeling pretty secure about in terms of security and the threats to this very plastic network. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nicole Staroselsky is the author of The Undersea Network and is a professor of media, culture, and communications at NYU.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Help! I got it.
Hi, my name is Aaron. I'm playing beach volleyball.
Bump it over.
I'm originally from England. We don't have a lot of beach volleyball in England. Although we have a lot of beaches, it's bloody cold, so we don't bother.
4-6, ball.
This is about the only state you can play volleyball in all 12 months, so it's pretty awesome.
Tight.
It's a good form of exercise. It's in sand, it's great for your legs. You can throw yourself about, you can literally dive in the sand. It doesn't hurt too much.
Get there, run!
We all want to win. We're all trying our hardest to win, and we'll play aggressively, but then we'll, go. Shake hands and have a drink with each other at the end.
Aaron Standring playing beach volleyball with the Funkalicious Beach Ball League in Tempe. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we deserve to get spiked, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Phoenix Theater's season this year will be a bit longer than usual, with shows in June and July. That means some of the theater's apprentices will likely stick around a little longer than normal. The company brings on apprentices in areas like set design, props, and costumes. Here to talk about that is Josh Lutton, a costume apprentice originally from Indiana, and Mary Lou Stevens, Phoenix Theater's Associate Managing Director.
There are a number of people that are interested in the field, and it is very competitive. So I think that we do get kind of the cream of the crop.
Josh, how did you get hooked up with this?
Actually, one of the development
associates of the theater. I worked with her a couple of years ago in Summerstock, and she was going for this apprenticeship at the time, and I was going into my last year of college. And she was like, you know what, you've really got to try it. Phoenix Theater sounds really nice and everything. So I was like, oh, yeah, I'll totally look into it.
And what are you doing there?
So basically I'm helping with build costumes for the productions that we do. So, yeah, just kind of sewing, crafts work, stuff like that.
Is that something that you ideally would like to continue doing? Like, is that what you'd like to do with your career?
Yeah, I want to go into costume design, but I feel like as a costume designer, it's very important that you know how to make the costumes and kind of what you're envisioning, so you're able to tell your cutter draper or your stitchers, like, hey, this is what I want. This is where I want this seam and all this stuff, so you can clearly say, and so they have an idea of what you want.
Mary Lou, it seems like these are the kinds of jobs that theater companies aren't necessarily doing for themselves anymore. Is this the kind of stuff that tends to be outsourced now?
I think it depends on what type of theater you are. Presenting houses obviously are a very different genre, where the tour comes in, they unload, they present, and then they leave. Being a producing house, it also varies regionally based on what types of full-time positions you have versus what types of things you're going to contract out. So Phoenix Theater is somewhat unique in that we do have a full-time props master on staff, and that's very important to our mission and how we do our shows. However, it's the same thing. We bring in a lot of different designers, but we do have a full-time staff in our costume shop and a full-time staff that builds our sets, because that is also important. We are really, part of our mission is really giving opportunities for these types of artists to work in the field and to get the training that they're looking for.
Is that unique among sort of your peer theaters of your size and of what you do?
I think that, you know, it varies greatly, and I think that we are unique in the sense that we do have several full-time positions, but the piece that's not unique is that every theater company that I know of, particularly nonprofits, utilize apprentices or interns in some fashion, because simply we couldn't do it without them. The nonprofit world in particular is very reliant on a volunteer base that helps you get the job done.
Is there an element of somewhat self-interest here that, you know, you need people to do these jobs, and with an apprenticeship program, you can train them to do it exactly the way you want the jobs done?
Most definitely. And I think that it also gives us an opportunity to see what the different colleges around the country are actually teaching in terms of these disciplines, because those things change all the time out there. And so we do have an ability to say, these are the kinds of standards that we have. And I think we've been very successful with our program, in that many of our apprentices immediately get jobs right out of doing their season with us. And we've actually hired several of them at Phoenix Theater to work after they've completed their apprenticeship.
Josh, do you think that having gone through this program will help you get a job when the season is over?
Absolutely. I am actually planning on going to graduate school sometime, hopefully soon after. But with the things that I've learned here, will definitely put me on top of that list of, like, applicants. And I think that's, like, really important that that I have that opportunity to be, like, working in a professional theater for, you know, however many years, and then go to school and say, hey, I know this much stuff, as opposed to all these, like, fresh out of college who may not know all this stuff. I am a better candidate. I'll be able to serve your theater program in a better capacity.
What kinds of things have you learned that you think will be the most helpful there?
One of the things that I really like about this program is that I'm able to get a bunch of different skills from many aspects of costuming. So crafts work. Actually, we're just making trees for Wizard of Oz, and so it's a lot of foam and covering that in burlap, so it's just different, like, crafting, some wig maintenance that I'm doing right now for Toxic Avenger, as well as some design assistant work, kind of looking at the designers, seeing how they're designing things and how they're communicating with the staff on what they want, helps me kind of get an idea of what I want to do and how I want to communicate. So it's just getting all these different aspects that make me more, like, rounded candidate.
Mary Lou, what is the learning curve when you have a new apprentice coming into your shop?
It's a great question. We are a very fast-paced environment. And when you work in the theater, that opening night is a hard deadline. And so the learning curve is very quick. They come in, generally they start at the beginning of the season, right around August, and we have our first show up at the beginning of September. So I would say it's a very quick learning environment. But the good news about that is that when you are a fresh graduate out of college, it's very difficult to break into this industry. And so this is that bridge, that opportunity to come in, get right in, get the work, and see it come to fruition. I've talked to many of our apprentices, and they say the biggest thrill that they have is seeing all of those little details that they worked on come together in the production.
Mary Lou Stevens is Phoenix Theater's Associate Managing Director. We also heard from Josh Lutton, a costume apprentice at the theater. And be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. We'll hear from residents of a couple of Phoenix neighborhoods on what they'd like to see in a new police chief for the city. And graduation rates are up across the country. Are they also up in Arizona? We'll find out tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. The managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, and the executive producer is John Hoba.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas. You can reach us at theshow@kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Citizens Clean Elections Commission, helping to take the guesswork out of voting. You can pledge to vote informed for the 2016 elections on the issues that matter most to you. Details at facebook.com/azcleanelections.